Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today, we're going to be discussing the Kenyan-led multinational security support in Haiti. I'm joined by a very special guest, Dr. Ruth Namatovu. Dr. Namatovu is a US-based analyst of peace and security, and she specializes in international affairs for Africa. She writes for the Africa program at the Wilson Center and also for Voice of America. Ruth, you've written quite a number of excellent pieces on several African countries, Somalia, Ethiopia, the Horn of Africa and the Sahel as well. I'm happy to have you join me today to discuss this topic.
I'm happy to be here today. Thanks for having me.
Good. So since last, was it last October or sometime late last year, the UN Security Council greenlighted the international force in Haiti. And surprisingly, for me anyways, Kenya was to lead that multinational force. We've seen over the years in Africa, which, we'll get into a minute, that we've seen African-led peace operations. But these operations have generally been within the African continent. But we're seeing, this seems to be exported outside of the continent. What do you make of this situation?
Kenya has been supporting UN peacekeeping missions since 1988. So first, within the region, they first began their peacekeeping mission in Rhodesia, which is now the current Zimbabwe, in 1979. But from 1998, they began supporting UN international peacekeeping missions. And they were first deployed in the UN mission in Iran and Iraq. And then since then, they've been sending military observers to several of other UN peacekeeping missions. They've been to Namibia, Croatia, Liberia, Sierra Leone, Mali, Darfur. They were also in Bosnia. They've been to Kuwait, Western Sahara, Mozambique, Rwanda, and Angola. So they have a history of sending military observers. But this specific one for the Haiti, of course, would be a little confusing as to why. But my thinking is that since they've been receptive to any sort of peacekeeping, when an invite was sent, they would have accepted it. But also, originally, the Haiti government with the former prime minister had requested the United States to deploy to help them quell the gangs there. But then the United States said no. But the United States then decided to float the idea to the UN Security Council to find a multinational force that can be deployed there instead of the United States. So my thinking that since Kenya is a great ally of the United States, either Washington could have asked Nairobi if they could do this, or Kenya could have just raised up their hand to say, listen, we've done this before and we are here, even though most of their deployments were military observers and not the direct involvement of the police. The only police that I really know that now is deployed in Somalia. And these are individual police officers that help train the Somali army. I mean, the Somali police forces. So I think they are riding on that to expand into proper, I don't know, this is not peacekeeping. It means this looks like peace enforcement. It's not peacekeeping in Haiti. So I think now they are also trying to test out their own police force on what they can do.
Very, very interesting that it makes a distinction. We'll unpack that in a minute. But you did say something about Kenya, I know Rwanda as well, I know Nigeria, the Gambia, they you know, definitely send troops for UN peacekeeping missions. But then, but this particular one is not a UN mission, is it?
This is not a UN mission, but it's a UN-backed mission. You know, the United States has had a policy of when they want to do something, they did it in terms of actually intervening in other missions without necessarily the approval of the UN Security Council. And even if the UN Security Council said no, if the United States says we want to deploy in Afghanistan and the UN Security Council, no, they would, as the United States. But this time round, the United States decided to use the UN Security Council to get backing, to set up this multinational force, so that a force that goes in there, of course, has to get funding from the UN to be able to quell the gangs there. So, which is quite also unique to the United States. And it must have been the United States that was could have set up Kenya for this very role to take the lead. Because they would be looking for which police force is organized, which one has a good command structure that can actually manage the multinational mission. Kenya is only sending 1,000, but the 1,500 are going to be coming from other Caribbean countries like Jamaica, Bermuda,
Belize, Barbados.
Barbados,
yeah,
and
Barbados, yeah.
But then there's also Bangladesh.
I think there's two African countries as well. I think Benin and Chad as well. Did I don't know if I...
No, there is Bangladesh and Chad. I think Chad is the other. Usually in such missions, what I notice in such missions that the lead mission must be completely distant from the region. I think that's why then Kenya comes in. So that you don't really, they won't be biased or paying allegiance to any of the countries within the region, because when you look at Kenya, it really has nothing to do with Haiti, nor has it strong relations with these other Jamaica and other things that they would influence their decisions when deployed. So usually missions do that.
I agree with you, because Kenya never even had a military agreement. I think that's one of the things where the court in Kenya were opposing, because there was no military agreement between Haiti and Kenya in the first place, which they've only just signed following that criticism. So I think...
Now, what happened, because in the Kenyan constitution, it's the military that is supposed to deploy in such missions, not actually the police to go into active kind of fighting. So one of the lawmakers decided to bring that up and then to the case to court, which actually immediately once this went into court and it was raised, that's how now you saw the Prime Minister, former Prime Minister Henry, coming to Kenya to sign that agreement to deploy. And you know, within international intervention, once the host country accepts the intervention, then it's okay. You're not breaking any rules. So when they sign that memorandum, then everything moved. Unfortunately, he had to resign because the gangs were not happy and people were protesting. He had to resign, but I'm happy now that it's still happening with the transitional government that is set up.
There's something you clearly identified there. And it seems that this multinational security force is largely backed. It suffered logistically in terms of like raising funds. It's largely backed by, I think, by the US. So that distinction between the US and UN. So looking at it again, and there's also some kind of a parallel as well. So we've seen US-led interventions in Afghanistan. We've seen US-led intervention in Iraq. And we see how those ended. We've also seen UN missions in Mali, in DRC, and now all those have also had its own complications. So there seems to be a parallel with this. Is this a transfer of risks? Is this like risk aversion? Let's just transfer this, the US or the UN or whatever, the Western world trying to, you know, shift that risk taking to other players.
Yeah, you know, peacekeeping missions have completely changed from the traditional peacekeeping that we know. You know, before then, for any intervention to happen for peacekeeping, you know, there must have been a truce, an agreement signed between the warring parties, you know, to let people come and deploy. The case of Haiti, that's not the case. So there is no peace agreement there. So that means peacekeepers can't just go in. But then there is under, I think, chapter 7 of the UN Charter, where they can do peace enforcement. So once the host country accepts the intervention, then it happens. Of course, we have seen the African Union mission in Somalia, for instance. When that mission started in 2007, when the first Ugandan forces deployed there, most people said this mission was dead on arrival. Nobody thought that these African forces would actually be able to fight Al-Shabaab. And they were completely surprised the way the UPDF worked, and then other forces had to come in to join them later today to make Somalia what it is today. So while their fears of going into Haiti, which everyone has, because gangs, these are irregular forces. They're not professional. They don't care what you do. As long as they can make any significant damage, you know, that is what sells them across the newspapers. If they had to bomb or do something or kill peacekeepers, that's where they benefit from. So it worries everybody that these Kenyan forces might go in there and then they could be just killed the way you remember the Black Hawk down in Somalia. That's a big worry to everybody. But there are also chances that they could actually go in and do some work like what happened in Somalia. They could bring some sanity to some of these cities and at least push back the gangs that have now taken up the cities and town and then let people do their work. And once probably they do that, then the international community can also come in and settle in there to help, you know, help the local population there. You cannot tell. I don't want to predict what would happen. It could be bad or it could be good. But I know, I think for the first days, it will get worse before it really gets better.
Whilst we're talking about local population and how the intervention might go, there is the confusion regarding the Kenya status as the lead intervener in that mission, number one. Then two, the scope of such mission. Is it to just secure critical infrastructures like the airports, the seaport, or is it to, you mentioned something about peace enforcement or peace keeping. Is it about training the Haitian police? Is it about providing? So there's a whole lot of confusion regarding that. Can you speak on that?
I think current now, the number one mandate they have is to quell the gangs, which I think push them out of the cities and town, try to bring order so that the current government, the transition government, can be able to, you know, do its duties and probably serve the population before anything else. But usually the deployment would entail keeping safe all key infrastructures of Haiti. I think, you know, recently they were trying to take over the airport, which has now been recovered. So if they take over, if the gangs take up the airport, then there can't be any flights into that country or even any movement or to do anything. They would not even deploy. So while they have to do the installations, but they have to really go into fighting with these gangs, push them out of the cities and towns. You know, once you do that within the city, allow the government, the current version, the current government to function and push them, you know, to the outskirts, then the forces would now be expanding outside of the Haiti towns to continue pushing them really back. But gangs are not very easy things to fight, I might say. Like I said, they are irregular forces. They can do anything. They could be backed up by any terrorist group that could also retaliate against Kenya just to destabilize it, whether inside Haiti or even back home in Kenya or anywhere else. So it's a very tricky deployment, but I think Dr. Ruto is willing to take up the risk. He just said one thing, a big calling to humanity. So that's all he's saying, and that's why he's deploying. But I must say about the paramilitary group of Kenya, the paramilitary forces of Kenya are known for quelling riots. You know about the Kenya riots? They don't appear on the streets every day, but once they appear on the streets, people know that this should come to an end. Of course, it will be bloody, but they always do the job that they are called out.
And that's another thing as well in terms of how. So there are two things that are coming out from here now. I'll come back to the first one. It's like what is the issue in Haiti itself? So we'll get there, but I think we need to talk about what you just mentioned, about how these forces, even though they might get a job done at the end of the day, also the same thing in Rwanda as well, the Rwandan forces. And you saw sitting in Uganda, these forces have been used for the US counterterrorism initiatives in the Horn of Africa, in East Africa. But again, they've also been accused of human rights abuse. So like you rightly said, they, you know, it might be bloody, it's all usually very bloody, even though they get the work done. So people have always, critics have raised that issue about human rights. How do you see that moving forward? And then again, they've seen where they might be propped up, they might be helping, like the West, the US might be helping to prop up authoritarian governments back home whilst they're doing this bidding, whilst Ruto might be helping to secure peace in the world. They might, you know, they might look, the West or the international community might look the other way. Let's say, you know, if there's some militarized situation going in the continent. Do you agree with this assessment?
Maybe you may have to kind of restructure what you really want me to.
Okay, so what I would say, you're talking about the riot police in Kenya and how, you know, they can be effective but ruthless or bloody. So what it means to me is they might violate human rights.
No. That's not what I mean, that they might violate. Oh. You know, any fighting would be bloody. You know, there could be death, there could be injuries, there would be people caught within the crossfire. You understand what I mean? So if you're fighting an enemy, you know, you can't expect that everything is going to say, look, guys, move out of here, and then they move. It's not going to be that. Do you think it's going to be that? The gangs are going to fight back. You see what already they are doing. They burn up places, bomb up places, kill their own civilians and stuff like that. So in the event that these deploying forces are supposed to defend themselves, it could be to anything. Exchange of gunfire. I don't think they are going to be walking around with batons in that country, are they? Of course not. So they will be fighting back and dealing with these guns. That's all I mean. It doesn't mean that they will be intentionally going to kill people and doing things like that. But in such mission, usually when they are trying to clear up places, they usually tell the populations to move. Now, you know, the United States forces are already there putting up the camping, the sites for where these troops are going to be. Usually what happens as even they are building up these camps, the population tends to come to places that they feel are safe. So safe. People will be camping around where the multinational forces will be. So there must be shelters there for the civilians. Then the places where they come from is where these forces now go to kind of deal with the gangs. That's what happens.
So,
going to be slaughtering people. No, bloody. What I meant was like, it is going to be exchange of fire. They are not going to be walking around with batons or sticks like UN peacekeepers, because they're peace enforcement.
But within that as well, there's a possibility. So I've listened to one of the key leader of one of the gangs, companion of gangs in Haiti. I've forgotten his name. And he was against Kenya deploying to there's actually a threat of however it goes escalating the situation
everywhere. It will be the same everywhere. Once there is any intervening force, those they are trying to fight will say no, because they see it as occupation, foreign occupation. They wouldn't want any other force to come in, because now this force is going to be stronger than the Haiti forces. The Haiti forces are described as weak and lack infrastructure and equipment to do things. These the multinational forces are going in as international forces, backed by the UN and supported strongly by the United States. And I'm sure United States is going to equip them with the necessary tools that are required to really help them manage.
Okay, let's start from the benefits. What does Kenya benefit from this?
One, international recognition, and I also think that there is improving its diplomatic relations, one within the UN, and then the UN member countries that are supporting this. But I also have a feeling that they also want to try out their own police force, what they can do, because where they deployed, for instance, in Somalia, they have individual police officers. They are not armed or anything. All they do there is to train the police forces there. Their military is the one that has been deploying to fight. So if they are testing out their police force and then their paramilitary groups into such missions, I think they would benefit, especially if they really try to do something there and bring sanity to Haiti. And then say where the international community failed, at least Africa did it. So that would be my simple reasoning. But according to Dr. Ruto, he said the mission is a big call to humanity. That's all he says, which is also very, very important. But the other advantage from this is that, the forces deploying there will gain some access to new technologies. A mission that is supported by the United States, of course, you're going to be introduced to new military hardware technologies, how to gather intelligence. They're already being trained in the United States. The Kenyan forces have been training with the U.S. military in their base in Kenya. So these are some of the things that they benefit, the skills that will come out of this UN-backed mission.
It's quite interesting that is the police, because in the 90s, when we were seeing with ECOMOC forces in the 90s in Liberia, in Sierra Leone, we see some of those armies, so it was the army now, those troops that contributed, when they went back, due to the trainings they've got, the exposure they've got, when they went back to the individual countries, they became a threat to those regimes. So you see a lot of regime change, like in Gambia, for instance, you see a lot of challenges to that. But now when they have access to this, so my question before was like, access to some of this sophisticated training, does it have any, in terms of long term, does it have any, like for instance, will it threaten regional security? So if, for instance, if Because that region, in East Africa region, is quite a sensitive one. It's quite a very competitive one, where you see Rwandan forces maybe supporting the M23 rebels, where they see, you know, in DRC and all of that. There's always that, whatever. Is it going to present some sort of, I don't want to say arm race, but some sort of threat to regional security?
I wouldn't think so. I wouldn't think so. First of all, I think within the East African region, it could be only Kenya that actually has the state security forces. Do you see the transfers? It's different. In Uganda, what we have, the forces are owned by the president. You understand what I mean? Because these are revolutionary forces. They are owned by the person who came up with the National Resistance Army. In Kenya, it's different. The states, the forces in Kenya belong to the state. All these presidents that have been there have not been like Museveni that we went to the bush with 27 and then since then we've multiplied these forces. No. So in Kenya, they are state forces. So even when they come back home, they can't be a threat to Kenya because they are structured and it is a system and they are state forces. They don't belong to an individual. Uhuru came and left them for Ruto, and you see the transfer was smooth. There was no chaos in there. So when these skills come, they will only be utilized to develop Kenya's police force, and I don't think that they will do any harm even to any region. Kenya is not the type that would like to say, what will it be doing? Trying to invade Uganda or Rwanda or DRC? I don't think so. That's not Kenya. Such things are playing up between Uganda and Rwanda. Everyone knows Kagame knows Museveni, and once Museveni does something in terms of security, Kagame says Museveni threat is deploying in Congo because he's threatening my government. He knows he can use people there, but it's not the thing in Kenya, no.
Okay, that's quite interesting because we've seen where they've deployed in Mozambique. So I think there was one, there was SODOC and there was Rwanda as well. And surprisingly enough, the Mozambique people, Rwanda did a lot better than the SODOC mission. But let me come back to Haiti. So the previous UN missions in Haiti has been, you know, ridden with scandal. You know, and I can understand why the gangs or the group of gangs might be, you know, resistant to this force. How does Kenya navigate this? How would they avoid, you know, this kind of scandal? Because I see again they're talking about a lot of vetting, because we, you know, the scandal involved like sexual abuse as well with Haiti as well back in the previously. How do you see this Kenyan led this thing avoiding such? And is that what is leading to the delay in the deployment?
Well, I can't predict what exactly will happen until people deploy and begin doing their stuff the way they have to do it. But within their peacekeeping record, we haven't heard of such cases with the Kenyan, whether military or police, wherever they've been deployed. But, you know, for instance, in Somalia, so many cases of sexual abuse, violation of human rights have really been coming up, for instance, in Somalia, in line with the Ugandan forces. And these Ugandan forces have been punished for that. But there is no trace for the Kenyan forces where they have been deployed. Most of their previous missions they've deployed in the military, they've been military observers, probably not directly involved. But if we talk of, for instance, Somalia, where they are deployed in Kismayo and Doble with, I think, around 4,000 forces there. Still within Kismayo or Doble, and I'm saying because I've embedded with these forces when I worked in Somalia myself.
Okay.
There was no anything like sexual abuse or human rights violations. They work well with the community in which they deploy. And the only thing I know about the Kenyan forces is working with them in Somalia, both the police and then the military. They are very well organized and very professional. And I think you can easily notice that compared to the other forces within, for instance, the mission in Somalia. That's what I know about them. or for what I've seen for myself, what I've read, I haven't seen such traces. But you never know what would happen in Haiti. People are individuals. You know, it can't be the entire police force. Some individuals this time deploying could do very weird things. Who would ever think that the UN would go into a mission to deploy and then their forces, the United Nations forces, are accused of sexual violence? You know, so it's very strange. Even the theft that happened and corruption that happened within that mission under the watch of the UN. So you never know. But they don't have such a press.
Yeah, it's quite amazing. So how does that overall, we see it continental-wide now, how does that project Africa? So Africa is always seen as a region where it's independent, it's passive, you know. But now, does that bring any sort of benefits, positive benefit in terms of image to Africa as a whole? Looking at, does that also fall within the African, African agenda in terms of, like, you know, 2063 agenda, how they want to be self-sustaining and also have some kind of equal relationship with the rest of the world. Does this offer a route to that? Does it give us a little glance into what that might be, like Africa might be seen in terms of, like, its position in the globe, in terms of, you know, ensure you're contributing to global security, global development? Does this offer a route to that?
Yeah, I think so. And it's a big deal. The African Union, for instance, the African Union mission in Somalia did surprise, like I said, did surprise everybody on the work they've done with the Al-Shabaab, fighting Al-Shabaab there. And they've become a game changer in the peacekeeping industry. You remember in 1993, the U.S. forces packed up and left Somalia and abandoned Somalia. So when the African forces deployed there, everybody thought they can never be. If the Spurious, you know, the superpowers failed to bring peace to Somalia, how can these Africans do it? And they have done it. So now if this multinational mission is led by an African, an East African country like Kenya, and if they go in there and do a good job, you know, it sums up a lot for Africa and the African Union. And I think more of such interventions will now be floated to the African countries. By the way, Africa has very good forces. They have very good command structure. They are very good fighters. And I think they can do a good job. But I think we've been buried still under the colonial system where people think Africa is inferior and the West is superior. But now with the kind of conflicts that are going on, a lot of things have changed. I think it's now time to try out other countries, you know, to see what they can offer. We have seen now under the African Union, countries within and outside of the East African region, what they've done in Somalia. So if now Kenya is going to lead the mission in Haiti, now working alongside countries like Jamaica or Bermuda, Chad and Bangladesh, and then they did a good job. You know, it sends a very good signal to the UN Security Council in the way now how they have to mandate missions. They should not do missions excluding Africa in any international peacekeeping mission. I think it's in the right direction, you know.
I agree with you. And I think, again, this also reflects the multipolar nature of the world we live in, where we're beginning to see a break in that either homogenic country, that a hegemonic country that America had. And then, you know, coming from the Cold War, where we have the, you know, the Soviet Union and, you know, the West, and then the American hegemony, then we're seeing different alliances now, you know, middle powers, and, you know, we see BRICS and all of this, you know, presenting us the future. And but again, what if we look at the AU, we look at what Africa has to offer in terms of, like, conflict management, peace management, and how Africa is being painted as a continent of conflict and disease. Are these just, so I know the focus is about, we did talk about the contention between the 10. Is it peacekeeping? Is it peace enforcement? What are we talking about? I've had another guest come on board here that was talking about the comparing the missions of the 90s, the UN missions of the 90s that were more diplomatic, political solutions. Whereas right now it's all about, you know, stability, it's all about, you know, military. What do you think the African approach or African-led peace operations can offer to the world? Can they offer this other kind of non-kinetic, non-military kind of response to this, to these issues?
Okay, the gospel truth is that military intervention can never solve a conflict. Military intervention alone cannot solve a conflict. But military intervention preserves a stalemate. You know, for instance, in Haiti, what is happening now, it is gang, the gang crimes. They're using guns to fight. So when you deploy the military, it is just to help kind of contain the gangs, maybe reduce their power to whatever they are doing for the people. But above all, what is actually necessary to do is to get to the root causes of this conflict. What is causing the conflict? Bringing the two parties to the table, talking and seeing who wants what, and then they can find peace or do, try to share power. That is the most important thing. But the problem with most of these interventions is that when forces deploy and fight and some kind of normalcy comes to the place where they deployed, they rush into the state building, bringing this infrastructure, doing it, building hospitals, and doing it without actually solving the actual problem. What do these gangs want? This is the thing that most people have failed to do in all the missions. And that's why there is a recycle of these conflicts. When peace forces leave, or even while they're still there, the conflict escalates into something else. It now creates phases of the conflict because the root cause of the conflict has not been solved. But once, for instance, the police force deploys in Haiti, call the gang, the pressure put on the gangs is the one that is supposed to force the gangs onto the negotiating table. Because if they feel the pressure, they would always say, we want to come to the negotiating table. And the situation in Haiti is different from, for instance, Somalia, where we are having terrorist groups who are against any sort of intervention, and they want to bring in their Sharia law and everything. That's different. I have a thinking or a feeling that the gangs in Haiti want to be part of the government because they say governments come and don't do anything to the people. They are not helping. So there are higher chances that such gangs, once put on pressure, they can actually come to the negotiating table, say what they want. So you have to incorporate these gangs in the agreements into the political structure of that very country. And I think that can help, because from what I've heard these gang leaders say, I think it's about power sharing. They have a feeling that they can do something apart from just the people who are the more democratically elected, and then they feel that these people are not doing anything, and they are just in leadership, they are only benefiting themselves and their families and those people within government. So they have problems that are pressing them. For them, they think they are representing the people. From the day one, when I've been reading about this conflict and hearing what these gangs are saying, there are very high chances that these gangs can be brought to the negotiating table to say what they want. And I really hope that the transition government would accept such an initiative when the time comes.
Yeah, I do agree with you that every conflict is different, and there should be a custom approach to each conflict. Like the Somalia, like you rightly pointed out, it's one that has, you know, the extremist dimension to it, the religious dimension to it. But Haiti seems to be different. I've also listened So at least the major armed leader of the armed group that controls quite a large number of the armed groups there. And when you see this person talk and how they also try to present themselves as the Robin Hood of the people in terms of providing resources and all that, you see that it's something that can be solved in a diplomatic way. So and like Riley said, it's a question of, it all depends on how this mission is being framed. I think it's also important how this mission is being framed. But there's something you rightly mentioned, which is very, very key. And this is what we see in many interventions, even in many US or UN-led interventions. We've seen it in Libya, where at the end of the day, okay, Gaddafi is gone. So what is the long-term plan? What is the post-Gaddafi plan? Or we've seen it also in Iraq. Okay, what is his name? What's the president's name now? It's gone. So what is the post? So at the end of the day, we see that it leaves those places far worse than the way where we had these leaders. In Afghanistan, we've seen far worse. So I think that's the fear with Haiti as well, like Riley saying. So what do you think should be, if we were to advise the Kenyan government or this other, led government, are they acting as, because a lot of people have seen them as acting indirectly as a proxy or whatever for the US agenda or this kind of agenda, unwittingly acting for that? What would you advise them?
Yeah, of course, like I said, initially, the former Prime Minister Henry had requested the United States to deploy in Haiti to help them quell the gangs, but the United States said no. Of late, the United States is trying to avoid into deploying, forces, ground forces. They don't like fighting ground. They don't want to do ground fighting, this face-to-face. They use their drones and stuff like that. So African forces can do the conversion warfare. They are very good at doing that sort of fighting. So the United States then came up with an idea, say, listen, we cannot deploy, but we can do something. How about if we found multinational forces that can come? Of course, the good thing, there are some forces that will be joining that are from within the Caribbean, I think, which is a very good thing to this mission. So, and the United States, I think, has pledged about $130 million into this mission. Canada's said something about 128 or something like this. So this mission is going to be well funded, I'm sure, which would have been the biggest problem to the African forces coming into this mission. So if one says that proxy American, I think yes, because America is really pushing. America wants the peace there, but they don't want to be the people fighting for this peace. But my other thing is really thinking that since we have alternatives such as the African Union, where they've seen that actually these forces can do something, I think they're also allowing that anything that is not directly like America's neighbors or people they're interested in, anybody else can come in and help as long as they're willing to help. Like decentralizing peacekeeping. You understand what I mean? I think that this time they want to decentralize. If we are seeing that the US forces are now kicked out of Niger, the government says, please get out. The UN peacekeepers are being thrown out of Mali and DRC Congo. So it means that there is something that is not right with these countries or the UN peacekeepers we know about and want to try something else. And then they want to say, well, listen, maybe the Caribbeans, maybe the Africans can bring in something better. Maybe these people can talk better than us. Sometimes if you see countries like the United States, they might not be willing to talk too much because they have the money, they have the equipment, they have everything that works. This talking too much is not there. Africans are very good at communicating. They might have the sort of superpower the other countries have, but probably their kind of engagement can bring a difference. Haitians look like the Africans. Probably it is easier, to connect. You're not seeing the white man. You're probably seeing another African.
I was thinking about that. Yeah, I was actually thinking about that. Yeah.
don't kill your friends. I think we can do something. Can we please mediate and do something like that? And my thinking is that the biggest approach, they don't know what is going to happen. There will be a very big challenge to these forces coming into the Kenyan forces and all the others coming too, because if you don't know the environment and terrain, of course, the first days or weeks will be hard for them. So they have to rely on the local forces, on the Haiti local forces to guide them through the terrain and everything in Haiti. But now, the only problem that usually happens within the things when they are starting, there will be forces that probably will be working for the gangs, you know, leading these troops into traps and stuff like that. Those things usually happen in the first days of the missions deployed. Not everybody, probably some of these police forces are not actually against the government and they are pro the gangs. So you never know what is going to happen. So until the forces deploy and see what it's like, what they train, what the environment is like, what they can do and not what they can do, that I think that's when they really focus. They cannot go in one day and say, boom, we are starting from here and here. They have to go in for the first 3 or 4 months, just sketching out the whole area, how it looks, knowing where are these gangs, where are they deployed, what are their tactics, how do they operate, who do they talk to, who do they meet, because they are working with the community. They have to befriend this community to be able actually to gather some intelligence from the gangs. It's not, I don't think they will be flying in today and then deploying here and then saying, look, we are straight into fighting. No. And they could get up to surprise attacks on arrival. Who knows? It happened in Somalia on arrival at the airport. The plane was bombed. So because you're coming in, you don't know the area. They, you know, probably some American forces who have been there have already sketched out the intelligence and know what is safe for them there to deploy. But I don't think for now you can tell what they are going to see or experience in the past 3 months. And while they are there starting to study the conflict is when they will come up to say, what is this that we are supposed to do? When the Kenyan military deployed recently in DRC Congo as the East African Regional Force, what the commander did first there was not to go into fighting, was to find a way of talking to the M23. So before he just said, before we get into any sort of fighting or trying to fight you guys, can we talk? So the M23 accepted the dialogue. So they came to talk with this the Kenyan commander. And then, on principle, they agreed to move. You know what I mean? In the areas that these deploying peacekeepers wanted, they agreed to move. They shifted their camps far away from where they wanted to deploy. That was one thing. But now, the issue, what happened later, that this was a trick. They moved out of the place and went into places that the Kenyan forces, you know, never knew about, you know, camped back in areas that are very dangerous, that they would not go there. And then they changed routes on how they had to do their fighting against the Congolese army. But I think that was a good move for a start. They say, listen, don't fight us. What do you want? They say, we want you out of ABC. And they moved out, but all they did was to go and create other camps. They were, but created camps and then made completely new different routes to the places where they wanted to reach. So you can never...
I was going to ask you a last question, but you've really, really covered it. So I think I would just say to conclude, what would, in addition to what you said, how would you... Because like Riley said, you can never know how this is going to pan out. This will depend on a lot of the first few weeks or months and see how, you know, they hit the ground running in terms of how much they're able to integrate with the civilians and all that. But if you were to, like, just predict based on the Haiti environment, what can you see, like, if you see the future, how do you see it? And what would you advise to conclude with?
See in the future in terms of security.
Yeah, how do you see the situation in Haiti unfolding with this multinational security force? If we're just to predict based on, you know, the little we've seen so far, the the political environment, the difference? How do you see this unfolding, if you're just to like predict in terms of the long term? How will it unfold, and what would you advise?
The security situation in Haiti has been deteriorating or getting worse by the day. And the intervention of these forces, you know, is not going to make it any better in the first few days or months or even weeks. Because like you heard of the gangs already say, we don't want these people here. Mm. While these are planning to deploy, they're also planning to counter their intervention. So, you know, there is no opportunity that when you're deploying that, before you actually deploy, for instance, the whoever is leading this multinational team is going to be talking to the gangs via Zoom or anything to say, you guys, can we talk before you even come and do this? It's not going to happen. So you don't know what they expect. All I know that the Americans are laying the ground for them, putting up this camp. So probably it will be a safe landing when they land to Haiti. And then I know it is going to take them time to understand the conflict. You know, you're on the ground, you see how the communities live and who to trust and not that. Create intelligence is the most important thing. But my thinking is that it is going to be kind of tense as these troops deploy for a while before they actually get to work out how they are supposed to begin their real peacekeeping mission. And if they can land on a simple question like, can we talk? I think it will make, I don't know, but for some reason I have a feeling that these gangs can really come to the table even before all this fighting starts. But if you just go into force and not willing to get them involved in any other way, one thing they are going to be doing is defending themselves. You know, these people are going to come in with all sorts of machinery to destroy them, and they could be few or they could be many, or they could outnumber. You don't know if they are recruiting others now, or even the biggest fear with such groups or any irregular forces that always they have other groups linked to them outside within Haiti. They could be a terrorist group, a nation that is also supporting them and giving them all the sort of ammunition that they want. But if on any landing they say these troops are here and before we start anything, can we try to make peace? Can we try to talk? You know, before you even begin to fight. But this thing of peace, this thing of military intervention and getting into fighting only escalates the conflict. This conflict in Haiti, like many other we've seen, like you've seen Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, DRC, Congo, Mali, will stay until the conflicts, until the real the root causes of this conflict are solved. The use of a gun or force by intervening into a conflict of another country will never be solved, because this is an internal problem. You're bringing external people to come and solve it via military means of fighting. It's not going to work.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. Dr. Nabatovi, this is very, very interesting. We really appreciate your insights into this vision. I also share your hope that it's you know, they're able to bring these gangs to the table. And I agree with you that, you know, the whole law has to do with exclusion and the need to be included into the whole system. Thank you very, very much for your time. We really, really appreciate. I would keep you posted once this is ready to be published, and hopefully help us share it among your network. And I wish you all the best, and we'll keep watching the scene and hope, you know, everything goes well for the Haiti people and people and the forces as well that have been deployed.
Again, it was my pleasure being hosted on this podcast. I like it, Conflict and Development in Africa. I do a lot of conflict, so I hope I'll be on this podcast next, any other time when you invite me to talk about.
Yeah, we will definitely as the months wind down, and then we see how the intervention go. We'll definitely bring you up to come and, you know, talk about you know, the actual, you know. Thank you very, very much, Ruth.
You're welcome.
Have a great day.
Same to you.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you everyone for tuning in today. Join me to thank our guest, Dr. Ruth Namatovu, for her very, very deep insights and into the Kenyan-led multinational force that has been proposed to intervene in Haiti. I implore you to stay tuned for more episodes next week. For now, stay blessed and I'll see you next week.